And I'm Peggy Nelson.
And we're here every Friday, courtesy of WPKN 89.5 on your FM dial, to give you as much news as we can about all the arts and entertainment events going on. And one of the big events that's coming up will take place at the Westport Library from September 15 through September 29, and it's their Story Fest, an annual multi-day literary festival featuring a diverse array of award-winning authors and creatives. And when we say award-winning, I mean, my God, they've got two paragraphs of all the awards that all of these people have won over their lifetimes. And the one that we're most excited about, who is a guest today, is Mr. Dacher Stoker, who is the best-selling author and the great grandnephew of Bram Stoker, and he's going to be talking about the mysteries behind the writing of Dracula. Welcome to State of the Art, Dacher.
Well, thank you, Richard and Peggy as well. It's my pleasure to be here. I'm looking forward to giving my talk next week.
Okay. Let me just ask you, you would think that by now that all of the mysteries would be solved about Bram Stoker writing Dracula, but each day there seems to be something new, and I'm sure that you have found lots of new things. What is the fascination of the general public with somebody like your great uncle?
Yeah, that's a great question. For a book written 123 years ago, we're still turning up really interesting tidbits here and there. But the main reason is Bram didn't write an autobiography. There have been several biographies written about him. He was a humble guy, worked as a stage theater manager for Sir Henry Irving. So the focus in his life was not all about his writing. And then it's been in his death, we've been scrambling around to find notes left in certain libraries, typescripts owned by people like Paul Allen, really interesting things, letters in different archives, university archives. So forensically, people like myself, and I've spent the last 15 years doing it, I'm sort of acting as a literary forensic detective to go and find these pieces that will help us understand, so we can speculate, but with good reason, what inspired Bram Stoker to write this incredible novel that really changed the world, Dracula, in 1897.
Mm-hmm. I can't imagine anything more exciting than researching your own family history in coordination with this. It is
interesting.
And
you know, many people think, well, didn't your family tell you all these things? You know, didn't why are you having to look now? Well, you know, the family emigrated to Canada, and Summers, you know, he was one of seven children, and I was the great-grandson of Bram's youngest brother. So his son came to Canada, and that's how I got there. I'm now living in South Carolina. But the family didn't have that much information. As a matter of fact, Bram's widow, when Bram died in 1912, the same week as the Titanic, his widow, 2 years later, published a book called Dracula's Guest. She sold off some of his library. So the pieces, the notes, the typescript, some of these interesting journals, and one of which one of his great-grandsons had, what I published in 2012, they sort of dispersed. And I'm on this trail to kind of find things about the family, and they inevitably all lead to interesting things about Bram, because he was the very literate one in the family. The others were scientists, doctors, and civil servants, and so on. But Bram, being the writer, was the one that sort of kept copious notes. But as I said, they've all dispersed, and now it's my job to bring them back together to tell the story, and that's really the focus of what I do.
One thing that I thought was kind of interesting, he was also a theater critic. But in the material that I was reading, there was also, like, in parens after saying he was a theater critic, they were not highly thought of in their day. And I think you could probably apply a lot of that to the theater critics today, but you would think that somebody of his stature would have a little bit more influence or whatever. And then we, in my lifetime, there is a Broadway production called Dracula that Frank Langella played and was very popular. So he's sort of come full circle, hasn't he?
He has, and I've just got to touch on the theater critic because this being an art show as well, very interesting. Bram loved to go to the theater with his father in Dublin when he was a young boy. Uh-huh. And then when he was a student at Trinity College, he also had to work at Dublin Castle as a clerk in the Petty Sessions legal department, which was very dull and boring for a man of such, you know, turned out to be a real artist. He was a founding member of the Dublin Painting and Sketching Club. And he convinced the Dublin Evening Mail to allow him to write his theater reviews the night after the play was over as a constructive way so that people involved in the production could actually make adjustments. So he was one of those early reviewers that was trying to be constructive and helpful. And, of course, it turns out that he then wrote a very favorable review of Henry Irving playing Hamlet. That got him the interview with Irving. That got him the job. So for 27 years of his life, his writing was only part-time. He was a theater guy.
Huh. Okay.
What do you think his opinion would have been of Dracula, of the Dracula films that came out in the 1930s and 40s with Bela Lugosi and Lon Chaney?
Yeah, I get asked that a lot. You know, he died before it went on stage, but he did protect the dramatic rights. I think he would have been thrilled to death, even though they have departed from his original novel. But he would have known that very well, being a theater guy. This story, Dracula, being written in the epistolary style with lots of changes, is a nightmare to adapt to stage. And so nobody's really done it. Sort of faithful service on stage. It's just too expensive and too complicated. There have been a few movies, the 1977 Louis Jordan version, the BBC put on a three-part series, quite faithful to the book. But Peggy, all the other movies, I think he would have still felt it was pretty cool to have something he started inspired so many creative adaptations the concept of Dracula.
Yeah. Let me ask you the one thing that I saw in some of the information. It said that you decided to write a sequel that bore the Stoker name to, quote, reestablish creative control over the original novel. What does that mean? What happened during that time?
Well, Bram Stoker lost, he died at 1912. In 1962, the book went into public domain. There was really no getting back. Complete creative control. You can't. Once it's gone to public domain, it's gone. What I wanted to do is try to put the Stoker name back on the franchise of Dracula. I wanted to promote Bram Stoker as a writer. I actually put him in the novel as a character. Uh-huh. And then the most successful book, Dracula, the prequel, it's his story writing Dracula. And so I wanted to bring the person, the creator, and his creation full circle and back together again.
Okay. And that obviously was achieved with what you wrote.
Yes, and you know, it's been quite successful. We actually were the number one hardcover horror story in the UK in 2018, and we were one of the top five books by the Horror Association. So somebody obviously likes it, and I was pleased to get it done, to tell Bram's story, but fictionalize it, obviously, to kind of alert the world that Dracula was a story based on reality.
Right.
That vampires are real and you better watch out.
And do you believe that?
I believe the same thing I think Bram did, that many, many, many people in the world believe vampires are real. And he's got some of the notes and interviews to prove it. And that's what I'm going to be bringing to the Westport Library next week.
Have you personally had anything, what we might call supernatural, happen to you?
You know, Peggy, I try to stay open-minded about things. I get these little sort of feelings and shivers every now and then. I can't say if it was, you know, conscious or unconscious, if it was supernatural. But I do keep an open mind, much like Bram did, where he says there are mysteries in life which men can only guess at, which age by age they may prove only in part. So I try to stay open-minded that the spiritual world, maybe that's part of the hereafter. Maybe there is something about that. And he was convinced that that was also something that was a possibility. So I can't say I have proof, but I like to be open-minded about it.
Yes, I do too.
I do too. I just think it's very, you know, we have to keep an open mind of what's going on out there. Nothing can prove us wrong until the very end, I guess. We don't know exactly what's going to happen. But this one book, the one thing that I was so interested in also, he's the least well-known of all the authors, but it's one of the most well-known books in the history of publishing. And there's such a dichotomy there that I'm sure this is going to be part of what you're talking about at the Westward Library, right?
Yes, it is. I mean, it's sad and strange, but when you understand Bram being humble and not liking to draw attention to himself, and that's one reason I said that his notes have sort of disappeared, and luckily then the Rosenbach Museum in Philadelphia, his typescript is for Dracula, is with Paul Allen's estate. But his main job was taking care of Henry Irving, putting him in the limelight. Uh-huh. So as a result, everyone knows Dracula, you know, worldwide. But Bram Stoker, not quite as well known, and that's what I'm going to bring to the Westport Library, and hopefully people will understand him a little bit better when I'm done with them.
Mm-hmm. I understand that some of the material that you found was material that was actually excised from the book itself. Did you find something that you thought should really have been included and wasn't, or was it all ancillary and not necessary,
Richard,
that maybe an editor took out?
Here's, I mean, I can go into hours of detail, but I won't keep you all, but here's the proof, and some things you've got to find and put pieces of the puzzle together, but this one was quite easy.
Right.
The typescript of Dracula that Bram Stoker actually gave to Walt Whitman's lawyer in exchange for Walt Whitman handing over to Bram after Whitman died his notes on Abraham Lincoln. That typescript ended up in a barn in Pennsylvania after Donaldson's family died off and left the farm, and it was sold, and it ended up in Paul Allen's estate, which A.D. Barker and I got to go and analyze this. And we're not the first authors. A couple of others have, and I knew that this was a possibility, that right. The short story called Dracula's Guest was once part of the typescript. Well, this typescript starts on page 102. Oh. So 101 pages were gone somewhere. Oh. And when I analyzed the remaining pages in the typescript, I found three very distinct passages crossed out by hand and notes throughout this whole thing, which was Bram's style, even though this was the last thing on with Bram's hand before it gets taken over by the publisher. That three of these situations in Dracula's Guest were crossed out. So there's no question that Dracula's Guest was once part of the original typescript. Uh-huh. And so when J.D. Barker and I wrote Dracul, the prequel, we used that information and some of the characters in Dracula's Guest to dovetail perfectly with where the story originally started. And then analyzing his notes that live in the Rosenbach Museum in Philadelphia, we got to see these different letters that Bram was intending to put in, again, these 101 missing pages, and we incorporated some of those characters into our story. So it was it's a puzzle that we put together with a lot of, almost like Indiana Jones traveling around the world to get all the
pieces. I guess.
We were these literary detectives.
Right.
Fascinating, really.
It really is. And all of this is going to happen at the Westport Library in their Story Fest that's going to go digital. It's the third annual literary festival, September 15 through September 29, and you can actually participate in this on Tuesday, September 15 at 7 p.m. with a live virtual event featuring Dacher Stoker, the best-selling author and the great-grandnephew of Bram Stoker, and his subject will be the mysteries behind the writing of Dracula. And you can get the entire program and register for the events and everything by going to westport.org/events/StoryFest. And you can get even more information than we were able to talk about on the show today. But, Dieter, we really appreciate your taking the time to join us, and we wish you all the best on Tuesday.
Thank you to both of you for your interest. I look forward to Tuesday.
All right. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Bye. That was Dieter Stoker, the great-grandnephew of Bram Stoker, and he's going to be talking about all the wonderful things having to do with the mysteries behind the writing of Dracula. We're going to take a little break, and we're going to be back with Daniel Fitzmaurice right after this. Welcome back to today's edition of State of the Arts. I'm Richard Feniger.
And I'm Peggy Nelson.
And we're coming to you courtesy of WPKN, the FM station in Bridgeport, Connecticut, on the campus of the University of Bridgeport, 89.5 on your FM dial, and we stream worldwide at WPKN.org, wherever you might be. And we just got off the line with Dieter Stoker, the great-grandnephew of Bram Stoker, who's going to be appearing at the Westport Public Library on Tuesday, September 15. And right now we have online with us Mr. Daniel Fitzmaurice, who is the Vice President of the Connecticut Arts Alliance Board and Executive Director of Arts Council of Greater New Haven. Welcome to State of the Arts, Daniel. Thank you for joining us today.
Hi, Daniel.
Hi, nice to meet you. Thanks for having me.
Okay. Now, we've got a big event that's coming up, a nationwide election in November, but there is also a statewide, what we call, or what you're calling, Create the Vote in Connecticut. And let our listeners know what that means and what the aspects, the influence, I should say, as far as what's happening in Connecticut and the arts.
Sure. Yeah, no, thank you for the chance to do that. That's exactly right. You nailed it. You know, I think there's an election every year, and Create the Vote is, in short, is a tool. It's a campaign that Connecticut Arts Alliance has organized for the last couple of years to make sure that artists, folks in the audience, residents in Connecticut who love creativity, remember that their voice matters in these elections, and also to remind the candidates that there is power in talking about the arts, and talking about the arts is a positive thing for their role as a legislator or their role as as a candidate. It's a powerful piece of connection between voters and candidates.
Right. Theater is a lot more, any of the arts, I should say, is a lot more than just, hey, here's a stage, let's put on a play, or hey, here's a space, let's create an art gallery or have a dance group come in or whatever. It's a real economic engine that drives part of the economy in the state of Connecticut. And since we've been without it for the last few months, since at least March, a lot of these arts organizations and individuals are having difficulty surviving, and by having people get involved with this, it at least drives home the point that we need help, and when we get help, we are an economic engine for the rest of the state, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I would say yes, I mean, there's many ways to measure that loss. I would start by saying that the nonprofit art sector, which is what receives public support more generally, has lost $386 million this year, which is a lot. There's also another number to throw out is that, you know, the industry more broadly, the creative industry in Connecticut, including, you know, for-profits, has lost $2.4 billion. so far. But I want to also expand that conversation a little bit as well, which is what we do with the candidates.
Okay.
You know, one of the tools we use for Create the Vote is the candidate questionnaire. So, you know, there is a question about the economic recovery that the arts could be part of. But the key in this questionnaire and the key we want people to think about when they're talking to candidates is, you know, what can the arts do to make Connecticut stronger, not the other way around?
Okay.
And so, for instance, even we're asking them a question about how the call, the urgent, renewed call for racial justice in Connecticut, how can you include the arts in that conversation? Where can we be helpful in our stages and in our galleries and even in our schools, using the arts as a way of cultural connection? So there's only one of the five questions in our questionnaire is the pitch for help, because that is critical that our state legislators understand that this, we cannot be a supporter and a solution for Connecticut without the support that the General Assembly should be giving us.
Right.
But it's important to frame it as a benefit, a public good that the arts provides the state and its residents.
Uh-huh.
Well, let me ask you this, because I wasn't aware of this organization, so I'm so glad you're a guest today. How do we find out how our candidates are feeling? How can we identify who the candidate is that is as mindful as I am about the arts and as inclusive as I am? How do I find out those results?
Yeah, you could ask them, and I'm being a little silly. I would say part of this is a learning experience for a lot of artists, arts professionals, right? Every year we teach more people how to be more effective in their advocacy efforts, and we do that by modeling it, right? So I'd say the first question in the questionnaire is about their personal connection. We particularly framed it around the pandemic this year. You know, like, what have you been, what has benefited you and your family during the shutdown? What local art places are you missing now that they're not open? But you could talk to all your candidates about their personal connection to the arts. And I can tell from my experience, you'll watch their shoulders relax. You'll hear how much they want to talk about things that are important to them personally as a way of talking about things that matter to them as a policy. We are also hosting on the Connecticut Arts Alliance website a candidate finder, so you can enter your town. You know, as folks know, we have a House and a Senate representing everyone in all the cities and towns, and they're all up for re-election this year, or there are candidates running for open seats or in competition with incumbents. And you'll see there's their town, their email address, as well as whether or not they've completed our questionnaire. And so that's, I mean, but again, to simplify it, it's really, we hope that the end goal here is that you form a relationship with the candidates in your town, that is beyond this election, right? So you can engage them in the things they're doing. They want to be in the district, out in the community and connected with things, especially things that are creative like this. And, you can help them do that work.
Now, what if we find out, in using all that information you just gave us, if we find out that the particular candidate has not taken the pledge, what can we do for that?
So I would say one thing that we're encouraging folks to do who are residents in Connecticut is to take the pledge for Create the Vote. That's not a financial pledge. That's simply a pledge of action. And so what we're doing, we have a couple hundred folks who have made this pledge already. And what we're doing then is actually sending them a micro action to do every week so that the campaign is, you can take 5 minutes and send an email to your candidates and let them know that you want to hear what they have to say about this. So we are, it is a grassroots effort. It is a nonpartisan effort. It is a people-powered effort. So we are building, we are giving you all the tools, and, you know, taking the pledge is one way to make sure that you get those reminders. It's easy to, we're very close to the election, actually, all things considered. So, yeah, and also part of what this is about as well is, you know, these candidates are going to ultimately be in the Capitol together in January, and they're going to be working together. And so we're also trying to inspire that in the responses from candidates. You know, how are they going to respond to these immediate decisions they're going to have to make about the pandemic and economic relief and racial justice in Connecticut? And how can the arts be on their minds when they're in that room? That's a critical piece of this as we think about the next steps.
Right. Now, can individuals, including myself, take the pledge as well as the candidates?
Yeah, the pledge is not for candidates. The pledge is just for residents.
Okay.
So absolutely, we have institutions who have made that pledge. We have residents, artists, folks who love the arts, students, all of the above. Right now, a big focus of folks who are in our pledge database is about connecting with their candidates. The next step for that is through my sister organizations and the arts councils across the state, we're all going to be hosting a regional candidate forum, of course, over virtual platforms. So it's not going to be in person, but this would be the next step will be a chance for you to actually, you know, be in the room, quote unquote, digitally with candidates in your region, ask them questions yourself, hear them say their answers, right? Hear them practice what it feels like to talk about the arts and enjoy that experience, right? Have a captive audience to be supportive of their strong stance for the arts is really critical.
Do you have the support of Governor Ed Lamont?
So we did create the vote first in 2018 during the gubernatorial election.
Right.
And there were many highlights to that, including a candidate forum here in New Haven for all the candidates to attend. We also were a big part of the policy task forces that he had created after that as he transitioned into his administration. I would say we also believe that's why the arts has been flat funded through these challenging couple of years. So that is the stability that we requested from the administration and from politicians has been welcomed and received. Mission accomplished. Also, you know, if anyone remembers, he certainly appreciates the arts personally, and that is important and critical. There's many other things we can do in the next 2 years, and I actually think this election for the General Assembly is really important that people pay attention to, especially as this national election takes a lot of the media time and a lot of our energy. It's important that local lawmakers make a really big impact on our cities and towns. For the arts as well as for other issues we care about.
Okay. Now, what website can our listeners go to get more information, to find out who their local candidates are and where the pledge is so that they can send them to those candidates? Website is it?
It's ctartsalliance.org. And the opportunity to take the pledge is throughout. And just to be clear, it's really for three things: to vote by November 3rd and help increase voter turnout, connect with my local candidates, and engage my audience and community about issues facing the arts. So it's not a financial pledge. It's a commitment to be part of this grassroots effort. We also have a toolkit with the graphics, the data, the candidate finder, lots of materials out there for folks to explore. And we've heard from lots of candidates as well as folks in the pledge community who have been engaged in this, right? So I don't remember the candidate in particular, nor would I name them, but in their response, which we're publishing next week, we're publishing all the responses we've received from the candidates next week. He said something like, "I'm sure you all will tell me what I need to do if I'm elected because of the veracity that you have communicated with me so far."
Sure.
And that's important to remember. Candidates are not used to getting questions about the arts or questions about the creative community. So even if four or five of your neighbors in your town make the pledge and do some of this work, they will notice. They will take a big notice about the importance of the arts in our state.
Fabulous. We've been talking with Daniel Fitzmaurice, who is the vice president of the board of the Connecticut Arts Alliance, and he's the executive director of the Arts Council of Greater New Haven. And he's been talking about Create the Vote campaign that we want our listeners to get involved with, to take the pledge and to make sure that other candidates that are running are also taking the pledge. It's a great idea and something that we need for all of the arts in the state of Connecticut due to what's been going on with the pandemic. Daniel, we thank you so much for joining us today, and we wish you all the best, and I'm sure that We'll have a lot of our listeners calling, or I shouldn't say calling, but going to that website and taking advantage of the pledge and everything else. Thank you again for joining us.
Yeah. Thank you for your work, really.
Okay. Bye.
Bye-bye.
We're going to take a little break, and then we're going to be back with Jane Davila right after this. Hey, welcome back to today's edition of State of the Art. I'm Richard Feniger.
And I'm Peggy Nelson.
And we're coming to you courtesy of WPKN 89.5 on your FM dial. We stream worldwide wherever you might be at WPKN.org. And so far today we have had guest Dacher Stoker, who is the great-grandnephew of Bram Stoker. And Dacher is going to be at the Westport Library this coming Tuesday as part of their literary festival. And we just got off the line with Daniel Fitzmaurice, who is the vice president of the Connecticut Arts Alliance Board, and he's the executive director of the Arts Council of Greater New Haven. And he was talking about Create the Vote campaign, where we can influence our legislators to know the importance of the arts in the state of Connecticut. And somebody that we've had on the show a number of times, but she's never able to talk about what we wanted to talk about until today. And I'm talking about Jane Davila, and she is moving into a new nest and has lots of wonderful things for artists and artisans. Jane, welcome back to today's edition of State of the Arts. How are you?
I am great. How are you guys?
Well,
hey,
now
Jane,
that you're willing to talk to us about this special project, let's
so
go
exciting.
At it. Tell us what's happening.
Well, so this has been a three-year journey to try to find a home for the nest to expand into.
Right.
And it has been a journey. We have looked at a lot of old factory buildings in Bridgeport. I have stepped over more raccoon poop than I could care to even tell you about looking at some of these old buildings. You know, that the age-old problem of artists is that we need really interesting big buildings with lots of light that are very inexpensive.
Right.
And so they're not going to be in great shape for the most part, and we need to use our imaginations. And it took us a long time, but we did finally find a building that we really like with a really amazing, very supportive owner who loves the arts. And we're going to be moving sometime this fall. And we've been working on renovations for quite a while now. COVID slowed us down a little bit.
I bet.
Because supply chains all over the country are slow, and it's taking longer to get everything we need, and
right,
everything just takes longer. Don't you find the time is like weird right now too? Everything takes longer. The supermarket takes longer. Everything takes longer. So our project is taking longer as well. But
okay,
we're delighted thinking about, you know, the what's coming up for us. It's very exciting.
Okay, now are you able to discuss with us on the air why you had to move?
Well, so, you know, I think that any time, you know, artists are in a space and they kind of fix it up and they start to show people the potential of the space,
right,
other people are looking at the space and thinking, oh, that's more valuable than I thought it was.
Right.
And so, you know, that kind of fed into it. The other part that fed into it is that we have always had a waiting list. And we have always wanted to be able to accommodate more artists than we can fit in our space now. And so we're going to be going from 29 studios to 41 studios.
Whoa.
Wow.
And so that gives us the opportunity to welcome more people into our community and to expand and, you know, kind of make our community bigger and offer more to the city of Bridgeport as well.
Sure.
Well, you know, I read on the blurb that it was an old corset factory in Bridgeport, and of course the first thing that came to my mind was Warnaco. Is that where it is?
No, it's in the same neighborhood though, because there are a lot of old corset factories on the coast of Connecticut from New Haven all the way down to Norwalk and a little bit beyond.
Okay.
And there's a very, very rich history of the labor movement in those corset factories. It's amazing. Yeah. I started doing research when we found this building. Huh. The original name of the building was the Crown Corset Factory. And it's funny because Crown Corset Factory, the business itself, still exists in Bridgeport. It's on the east side of Bridgeport, and they make foundation garments now. Oh. So it's cool that the company, after all these years in the early 1900s, still exists and is still here. It didn't leave. But that the building now is getting this kind of new life. But the corset workers were mostly women. A lot of them were immigrants from Europe or Eastern Europe. Right. And a lot of them were very involved after watching the men organize and get labor unions, got involved in that. And there was a big strike in 1915 where all of the women workers in the corset factories in the Northeast, which included Bridgeport and New Haven and Norwalk, walked out. And it's the reason that we have eight-hour work days now.
Oh.
And it's tied to those women. It's the girls did it.
Yes. Now, does the corset factory that's still in existence know what you're doing to their old facility?
No, we have not reached out to them. I think they moved sometime back in the 50s or 60s.
Oh,
so
okay.
It's probable that the same people are not around. But
right.
I like that the legacy of the company is still Bridgeport.
Oh, sure.
And it's still here.
Sure.
Yeah.
Now, you said you had a waiting list, but are you also advertising for people to come in and they have to, I'll say like a theater person, audition or show their background or whatever?
Yep, we have a selection process. We have an application process. We have a selection committee. We currently have five spaces left. And so if anybody listening is interested in renting a studio as a visual fine artist,
right.
You can find an application on our website, and I'm happy to arrange a tour. I've been giving tours on a pretty regular basis of the spaces,
okay.
And we have some new people already committed to joining us, but we're looking for more. Because we are all about our community, we're a little bit picky about who joins the community. We want to make sure
that
person is going to be happy with us and that we're happy with them.
Right. So where do the potential artisans go to get this website, or what is your website?
Our website is nestartsfactory.com, and there's a link right on the first page.
All right, and it's Nest, N-E-S-T, like you're feathering your nest.
Correct.
Okay,
yes.
All right. I just want to make sure. Now, why do artists like to gather in a facility like this to do their art rather than to have an individual studio? What's the advantage?
I think I've been in both situations. I've been in other art buildings before the Nest, and I've also worked many years in my own house.
Uh-huh.
And I think some of the advantages are that you have a shared sense of being able to share both your, like, the agony and the ecstasy, like your successes and your failures.
Right.
Have people to commiserate and people to celebrate with.
Sure.
It also gives you opportunity for kind of professional development. If you're in a building like ours, then there will be somebody who knows the question that you're asking about Instagram or
right.
the technique, the encaustic technique that you're working on, or somebody who has the specific kind of tool that you're looking for who might be able to give you information about where to get it or maybe even let you try it out. And I think sometimes, too, because art making is so solitary and it tends to be something that you get into your head and you can get into a creative block if you're not careful, that by being in a building with a lot of other people that are all kind of working toward the same thing, everybody's creative, everybody's making things, everybody's kind of got that creative energy, that it lifts you up and it inspires you more than when you're by yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that when I'm in my studio and I'm working on my work and I've got my door closed and I'm doing my thing, even though there's nobody else in there with me, I have this sense or the feeling of that creative hum in the building around me.
Sure.
And it almost makes me feel like a bee where like I'm working and everybody else is working. And it really is an uplifting feeling.
Sure.
And the energy of that is great. And it also is, there's opportunity. You know, we have a lot of events where we're open to the public. And so we've got, you know, gallery owners and collectors and, you know, students, if somebody teaches workshops or those types of people coming through. You don't normally have people like that coming to your house. So
right.
you would have that advantage by being in a building like this.
Sure.
Yeah, I totally believe in the energy of the creativeness that's happening within the building. But how will the pandemic affect people coming in and out of that building? Are there certain rules that they have to follow?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, you know, when we were first in the lockdown, we left the building, open and available to the artists, the tenants. And there were several people who took advantage of that and some people who didn't, and that was fine. But once the lockdown lifted, we enacted all of the CDC recommendations. So all of our public areas inside of our building, you have to wear a mask. We have hand sanitizer, and we're encouraging everybody to wash their hands. We're treating our own studios as kind of, space that's safe. And so if you were working, the public is not allowed in the building right now, just the tenants. That's all we're letting in right now. But when people are in their spaces, it's just like being at home, except you're able to work because you have all your stuff and you've got, your creativity. And so we've noticed people were a little timid and a little frightened in the beginning, just like all of us about everything. Yeah. But we are really kind of back in full swing right now. Mm-hmm. And I honestly think that this is even a better situation than working at home, because you, like as an artist, your spouse may be home, your kids may be home.
Sure.
And now you've got a space to go to that's just as safe as being home, where you can actually get your work done.
Right. Now, the one thing we haven't talked about is the actual address of the new space.
So the new space is very actively under construction now and is not open to the public.
Okay.
And it's on Railroad Avenue in the South End, and it's near Park Avenue. And as I said, if anybody is interested in renting a studio and they want to fill out an application, I'm really happy to give them a tour. But we're going to be right a little bit south of downtown and very close to Brewport. So I think that we're in a good location. We're near the amphitheater. We're near Seaside Park. It's a good spot to be in. We're very excited about moving to the South End. I live in the South End, so I vouch for the neighborhood. I think it's a very cool neighborhood, and there's lots of interesting things going on and great people. And we're just looking forward to being part of that and contributing to the vibrancy of the neighborhood.
Okay, and that website that artists can go to if they want to fill out an application?
Is nestartsfactory.com.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for talking to us about the new space that you have. We've been talking with Jane Davila, and she's the manager of the Nest, and she's got all this information. It's great talking with you, Jane. I'm sure we'll talk with you again later on, but I'm glad we were finally able to get this out and let people know about it. Take care.
Thank you
all the
both.
Best.
I really appreciate it.
Thank
okay.
You.
All right. We've been speaking, or we spoke with Dacher Stoker, who's the great-grandnephew of Bram Stoker, Daniel Fitzmaurice, who talked to us about Create the Vote campaign and what you as our listeners can do about it. And we just got off the line with Jane Davila, who is the manager of the new Nest in Bridgeport, Connecticut. And that's going to do it for State of the Arts. I'm Richard Fenniger.
And I'm Peggy Nelson.
And we're going to be back again next week doing this all over with new guests. Thank you for joining us.